You're listening to the Always Forward Leadership Podcast,
featuring the leadership of Ron Kitchens.
The topics discussed today are designed
to keep you moving always forward.
Welcome to the Always Forward Leadership Podcast. I'm Ron Kitchens, and we're so glad you're joining us today, along with Charles Duhigg. Charles, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We're so excited that you're joining us for Catalyst University, January 26th in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and that you're going to share with us that your transformational work, both from The Power of Habit, which was a New York Times bestseller, along with Smarter, Faster, Better, which I guess was also a New York Times bestseller, you know, you truly had some areas in there that have both changed my leadership and changed the way I work with others, whether I'm coaching them or we're building our organization. So please share with us your thoughts on both the work you're doing and what we're going to hear at Catalyst.
Thank you. That's really kind of you to say. I really appreciate it. As you know, writing these books, it's like you bury yourself in a cave for 2 years. So it's always really nice to hear that someone actually read it, much less liked it. So thank you so much.
I did, in fact, read it, and I've given away lots and lots of copies. And as a matter of fact, our team does a book read where each month we read a book together and then we talk about the principles in it and how we can incorporate those principles into our own organization and into our own daily lives. Smarter, Faster, Better was one of those that we read as a team, and we're constantly referring to the concepts and the principles in it.
Oh, thanks. I really appreciate that.
Rather than me telling the listeners all about you, can I talk you into sharing with us a little bit about your background, how you got to this point, how you go in your career trajectory that earned you a Pulitzer Prize along the way?
No, absolutely. I actually started as an entrepreneur. I graduated from college and my wife and I lived abroad for a little while, and then I moved back to New Mexico where I'd grown up, and I started a company that would build medical education campuses for universities. And after the company kind of got its legs under itself, I decided to go to business school because I really didn't know that much about business. After running one, and halfway through business school, we sold the company that I had been building for kind of just a small company. And when I was in business school, I was trying to figure out, should I go back to New Mexico and start another company and go into business again, or should I become a journalist? And decided to become a journalist, in particular because I really like business. I like writing about business because at the end of the day, business is kind of what most of us spend a lot of our lives doing. And it's this very human, very emotional story, right? That the choices we make when we're at work and the choices we make about money and about what we do that gives our lives meaning, a lot of that comes from our family. A lot of that comes from the organizations we belong to. But a lot of it also comes from the place we go to do our job every day. So I spent a number of years as a business writer. I was at the Los Angeles Times, and then I moved to the New York Times. And the theme kept on coming up, particularly when I was, for a little while, I was a correspondent in Iraq. This theme would come up that people would change somehow, like somehow someone would change their life, or the U.S. military would come into Iraq and they would realize that they could stop riots from happening by removing food vendors from plazas, or some company would figure out that they were able to use data to understand consumers better than those consumers understood themselves. And I was fascinated by this. I was fascinated by trying to understand, why do people actually change, right? Because all of us want to change somehow. We want to lose 10 pounds, or we want to start exercising more, or we want to get along better with our mom or dad, or we want to ignore that annoying guy at work. How does change actually happen? And as I was getting closer and closer to that topic, I kept on thinking about habits, right? And people would mention habits to me. The military mentioned to me that the way that they figured out that removing food vendors from plazas stops riots from happening is because they realized that people have these habits that make them hungry, and that as long as you take the food away, a crowd never gets big enough to break into a riot. Or that when people want to have an exercise habit or where they want to stop smoking, that at the core of that isn't necessarily like this big conscious choice. It's about making this small choice. And so I was really interested in habits, in particular because I wanted to change my own habits. And my wife and I were about to have our first son. And so I had this crazy idea. My wife is a scientist. I had this crazy idea that we would go find like 20 studies about how people change, and we would try and live by them one at a time, like month by month. And so I went and I talked to a book agent. I shared this idea. and all the ideas I had for different studies. And she said, that sounds like the worst idea I've ever heard for a book. It's way too complicated. You're trying to do way too much. It doesn't sound interesting to me. But she did say, you know, you keep on talking about habits. Why don't you just write a book about habits, since that seems what you're actually interested in? And so that became The Power of Habit. And it ended up doing really well, which I was really thankful for. And yeah, that kind of taught me how to write books. And so then after writing The Power of Habit, you know, The Power of Habit came out and it did well, which was great. And the same year that it did well, I was working on this series for the New York Times called The iEconomy that ended up winning the Pulitzer Prize. And so professionally, it was a very successful year for me. And I would come home and I would say to my wife, you know, like we just had our second kid. I'd come home and I would say, if this is what success feels like, then sign me back up for failure, because this is terrible. Like, I am working all the time. I literally, all I want to do is have dinner with our sons. And like, I've got 100 emails I have to deal with. And then I've got 3 hours of work to do before I can fall asleep. And so I decided for the second book, I was really interested in why some people seem so much more productive than other people. Why some people, we all only have 24 hours in a day. So why do some people seem to be able to get so much more done without being completely stressed out about it? And so for the second book, I decided to try and figure that out by talking to researchers and asking them, why are some people and companies more productive than others? And these really interesting answers came out.
You know, I think that it really was amazing, the things that came out of the book and out of your research. And in particular, I know two stories or two areas that really fascinate me are both Lorne Michaels as a leader and then what he was able to do with Saturday Night Live and build a team that's really translated for over 40 years. And then what Google has been able to do with those same principles. Can you kind of share that with us and how that all kind of came together?
I love those stories too. So the interesting thing about Saturday Night Live is everyone knows Saturday Night Live, right? But when you think about it, when Saturday Night Live was starting, it was deemed the least likely show to succeed. And the reason why is because Lorne Michaels, the executive director, this is basically how he pitched it. He said, I want to go find a whole bunch of comedians who don't know each other. And I want to put them in a room together. And, you know, comedians, they're not the most sociable people on the face of the planet, right? Like, many of them are a little prickly to begin with. And Lorne Michaels' idea was, I want to have them all compete to come up with these sketch ideas. And then I'm going to choose which ones are going to go on the air. And if one goes on the air, it means another one's getting cut. And by the way, I want to do it with all these people who, because it's the 1970s, half of them are like drugged out half the time. And most of the people in the room have all slept with each other and like probably aren't speaking at this point. So this was his idea, right? Was like, I'm going to take the least likely group on the face of the planet to actually like make a show together. And then to add some extra pressure, I want to make it a live show that we do once a week where we can't even like put it on tape. So if people are angry at each other, we can edit it out. And what's crazy is that it worked. It only worked. It's like one of the longest running television shows in history. And so I was really curious, like, why? Like, this seems so unlikely. Why did this come together? And so I went and I talked to Lorne Michaels, and I talked to a whole bunch of people who had worked on the first season. And they all said the same thing. They all said, the reason Saturday Night Live was such a success is because Lorne Michaels has this, like, crazy system of leadership, which is that Lorne Michaels, he's a kind of socially awkward guy. But when he's running meetings, he does these weird things where basically he forces everyone in the room to talk. Like if you're standing against the wall and you haven't said anything in 10 minutes, Lorne Michaels will just say, hey, Jim, what are you thinking right now? I want you to say the first word that comes into your mind. So he makes everyone talk during these meetings. And then the way he listens is this like weird thing that actually psychologists call ostentatious listening, which is that you show that you're listening so overtly that everyone else notices, right? So you repeat what the person just said to you. You pick up on all their nonverbal cues. So if their arms are crossed, you say like, hey, it looks like you're not happy with this idea. Tell me what you're thinking. You almost kind of like badger the person into speaking and then like you overreact in your listening activities. And what's weird is that in group settings, everyone else will start doing the same thing. People just kind of naturally mimic what the leader of the group does. And the people I talked to said, everyone who worked on the first seasons of Saturday Night Live, we didn't like each other very much, but we all got along really well because Lorne Michaels would do this weird thing whenever he would run a meeting. And so I thought that was kind of interesting. And then I started talking to companies and I found out that Google had spent 4 years trying to figure out how to build the perfect team. And they had basically come to the same conclusion that Lorne Michaels had come to, which is that if you force everyone to speak up at a meeting and you engage in ostentatious listening, it's almost impossible for that team not to kind of come together and gel. And in fact, Google believes this so much that they've instituted all these rules about how people have to hold meetings now. That, for instance, when you start a meeting, everyone, most importantly the group leader, has to close their laptop so that you can make eye contact with each other and engage in ostentatious listening. And when you think about it, the fact that the largest computer company on the face of the planet tells everyone that they have to start meetings by closing their computers, that's actually kind of like a signal that they found something that's really deeply important to them. And so that's where that chapter came from, was that there's this science of teams that we tend to think of the perfect team as like about being who's on it, right? That you want like a mix of introverts and extroverts, or that you want people who are friends away from the conference room. But like basically all this data shows that doesn't really matter. You can have people on a team together who dislike each other, but if you have the right group norms, if you have the right habits of behavior, it ends up making that team work.
I think that's great, not only advice and data, but it also shows the power of leadership. If Lorne Michaels doesn't model that behavior, if the leadership of Google at meetings don't model that behavior, then followers won't model the behavior in their own teams and allow them to react in ways that will destroy their smaller teams or destroy the entire organization. It allows infighting that doesn't create the Saturday Night Live or Google experience that drives quality up and constantly improving your best by not modeling that behavior. We allow others' bad behaviors to not build our organizations.
I totally agree. I think that's exactly right. And throughout the book, Smarter, Faster, Better, I think one of the things that it emphasizes is that the most productive people throughout history, the thing that they have in common is that they train themselves to think a little bit more deeply, right? They find these routines or these habits that push them to think more deeply about what their goals ought to be, about how they should prioritize their time, about how they should treat a group. And that part of that is actually recognizing that leadership is incredibly important and that each of us is a leader all the time, right? Even if it's just a leader to ourselves, that by making deliberate decisions, by saying, I want to structure my life in such a way that I'm pushing myself to think about the choices I'm making, to think about my goals, that is an act of leadership. And that in many ways, being a leader within an organization, within a company, it's just taking those personal elements of leadership and just kind of expanding them a little bit bigger.
Those are pretty simple early lessons that we learn, but for some reason, we defer when we have the opportunity as adults to execute around those early lessons. Let me go back to something you said. You talked about success was overwhelming. All you really wanted to do was have dinner with your wife and your two sons. What changes did you make to ensure you had productivity at work so you could have quality in your family life and your personal life?
Well, so one of the things that I did is I spent a lot of time pushing myself to think about what my priorities were, right? Because I think one of the things that can particularly happen in today's economy is that you can become so busy that you're never productive, right? And this happens all the time. Like, I literally can spend every hour of every day doing something that seems important and never spend time doing what's actually important.
You mean like managing my Facebook followers?
Totally, or just responding to emails, right? One person I was talking to, he said, like, this is the problem with email, is that most people use emails like a to-do list, right? Like, my inbox is like what I need to get done today, except that it's the worst possible to-do list on earth because it's a to-do list that you've given permission to the rest of the world to add any item to, right? And that's the issue, is that you can feel busy. You can be busy all the time and never be productive. And so one of the big changes that I made was just carving out time and, more importantly, carving out a process, an activity that pushed me to think more about my priorities and to check to make sure that what I'm doing actually aligns with my priorities instead of is just reactive because that's easier. So like one of the things in the book that I discuss is this process of kind of stretch goals, right? That people who are most productive, they tend to write to-do lists where they don't fill it up as like a memory aid. It doesn't have a list of tasks on it because one of the things we know is that your brain tends to look for the easiest task and do it because it craves that feeling of accomplishment. That instead, what the most productive people do is at the top of their to-do list, they write one big goal. What's my most important thing for today? What's my most important thing for this week, for this month, for this year? And then that way, if they just spent the last half hour, you know, if that big thing at the top of my list is to get this memo written I've been putting off for 3 weeks, if I just spent the last half hour returning emails and I look at my to-do list, it reminds me, I'm basically avoiding that memo again. Like, I need to close my computer and do that memo. That's sort of an example of one of the things that I've started doing that I think has made me more productive and has helped me regain control over my life. And when psychologists talk about these types of things, like a to-do list this way, they talk about them as contemplative routines. Because as I mentioned before, this thinking more and thinking more deeply is really important. The problem is if you say to someone, I want you to think more, everyone will say, absolutely, I need to think more. But it's really hard to just remember to think more, right? What you need is you need some activity that pushes you to think. And that activity might be writing a to-do list in a certain way. It might be that when you have one friend that you have, or your spouse, and this is one of the things I do, is I come home and I describe my entire day to my spouse, and she asks me questions. She says, like, why did you do that today? That doesn't seem like the best use of your time, right? That's my contemplative routine, is basically describing my day to my spouse and having her interrogate me about why, what the choices I made. And I do the same thing to her. And the point being here, that saying I want to think more isn't enough. You have to create these routines or these habits that actually push you to think more, because thinking is hard work and we'll avoid it if we can. But if you have these habits, then you end up thinking a little bit more deeply.
I think that's critically important. As we work with leaders and coach, and I really try to help organizations grow, one of the things we continue to see is leaders who are getting more done or spending more hours working. I don't know if they're actually getting more done, but they're taking the time away from the families. And we're seeing a crisis in leadership and with their families because the exact thing of, I can't go home because I have 100 unanswered emails. Well, unless you're an emergency room surgeon, nobody is going to die if you go home. You probably can even go home and worry about those emails later, or never worry about them and just let them disappear into the ether.
You probably can. I think that's exactly right. And part of it is just like testing that theory with yourself, right? Like, you know, one of the interesting things, there's a study that was done of the email habits of very productive people, and particularly people who tend to be successful in Fortune 500 companies. And what they found is that the people who are uniquely successful, they tend to delete emails more than anyone else. And what's interesting is that they tend to delete emails within the first half second of looking at them, which basically means they're not really reading them. They're just going through their inbox, so they're just hitting delete, 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 delete. Because, as we all know, what tends to happen is, if you send an email to someone, sometimes you just send it for some dumb thing you can solve on your own. And if they don't respond to your email, you go solve it on your own. And if it's really important, you email them again, or you pick up the phone and you call them. And so this is another thing that I do. I hit delete much more frequently. Basically, my feeling now is the third email is the new first email. If it's really that important, someone's going to email me 3 times, or they're going to pick up the telephone. And if they don't, it's probably a problem that they've solved on their own.
That's some great advice. You know, I recently had my gallbladder removed, so I ended up out of the office for about a week. And for several of those days, I was really out of it. And I went back to the office after that week and looked at the email and thought, there's no way I can answer all this. So I just deleted them all. I didn't get a single complaint after a week of emails got deleted. So I'm beginning to think that I'm not really that important, nor are those emails.
That's right.
We're up against a hard stop today in time. And so I want to thank you for being here. But I have one last question.
Yeah.
How can leaders who are really trying to thrive and do amazing things, how can they do both successful at work, successful at home, not give up the cool things? How can you get it all? What have you found in both your research and your own life?
I'll tell you what the research says. The research says that there are some people who can get it all. And the reason why is because they decide what it all means, and they just commit to doing that and not doing the rest of it. Some of the folks that I talked to were people who, it's just amazing their accomplishments, right? Like one guy in particular in the book, he's a surgeon. He's a writer for the New Yorker magazine. He's a father to three kids. He won a MacArthur Genius Grant, and he helps oversee this big program at the World Health Organization. And he's a really nice guy who doesn't seem super stressed out. And I basically asked him the same question, like, how do you get all of this done? And he said, well, those things that you said, like, that's all that I do. Like, I don't reply to emails. I have a core group of friends that I really like, and I spend time with them, and I don't spend time with other people. In fact, basically, it took me forever to get him on the telephone because he wouldn't take my phone call for a long time.
That was the story I was going to ask you to talk about, is the fact that he told you no, that he didn't have to talk with you. But then you, as a leader who knew he had a special story to tell, followed up on that and asked again, and you didn't take that first no as the ultimate answer.
Oh, absolutely. Basically, I use this social peer pressure because we have a friend in common. But I think the point there is that if there's someone who feels like there's all this stuff I want to do and I can't do it all, I think the answer is to sit down and make a list of what are the things that you actually want to do, and then pay attention to a couple of days in your life of what you're actually doing. And if the way you're spending your time doesn't line up with that list, then just cut out the things that don't appear on the list. And I know that's easier said than done, because oftentimes the things that take up our time that aren't on that list are things like obligations we have to other people, like to our kids or to our parents. It's replying to emails. It's going out and, you know, like doing the job that we maybe don't like so we have time to pursue our passion. But I think the point is that we can get trapped in that mindset so easily where we say to ourselves, I can't do it all. I have to reply to that email. It's bugging me that it's in my inbox. Or, you know, this person asked me for a favor. I really should do this favor for them because I'm a good person. Or this person has a problem and I'm going to help them solve it. The first step is to say, I am in charge of my own life. If I'm spending 50% of my time on stuff that does not line up with my real goals or aspirations or priorities, that is not the fault of the world. That's on me. I need to start making different choices. And what I have found is that when people take that step, they start being productive for the things that are important to them, and everything else works out.
That is great advice, and that's great advice for us to transition on. So Charles, I want to thank you for joining us today, and more importantly, I want to thank you for joining us January 26th at Catalyst University. I know you're going to change people's lives, and we're so glad you've agreed to say yes.
I'm really looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you all for joining us for the Always Forward Leadership Podcast. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for joining us for the Always Forward Leadership Podcast. We hope today's insights will help you develop into the leader you dream to be. To subscribe to Ron's blog or to submit a question for Ron to discuss in a future podcast, visit ronkitchens.com or tweet him at ronkitchens.
Thanks for listening. I know the fall is a busy time of year, especially for college students. I wanted to take a moment and tell you about a resource that'll make your internship search much easier. www.miinternship.com is the resource for you. You can view available local internship opportunities and apply directly on the website. Check it out at www.miinternship.com.